Hello and welcome there to Radio Free Nintendo, a Nintendo podcast for grown-ups. And we've got the grown-uppest of all grown-ups here this week, returning, Jonna what? Jonna who?
Jonna Lindemann, baby. Woo!
All right, Kat, this is really important. John, for the last 6 weeks, you have just been gone from our lives.
Correct.
And I don't mean just on the podcast, but in the day-to-day operations of the site, you've not been around.
This is true.
Although John writes nothing.
I try to avoid it. That's right.
Yeah, you do an admirable job.
Are you saying his job is easy?
No, I'm not saying his job is easy. I'm actually about to say the opposite. I'm going to say that while he doesn't write anything for the site ever in the entirety of existence, he does provide a certain stabilizing factor that the site has missed in his absence. And I know that our listeners are happy to have him back, just as happy as we are. And I'm going to tell our listeners, in case this happens again, how I've been coping with John being gone. And that's because I've been following John on his Twitter page at twitter.com/John Lindemann. Check it out. No, seriously, check it out.
You know I'm going to check it out right now.
It's been the only way I can connect with John while he's gone.
I have no idea what's going to be at this page.
It's magic. That's all I can say.
I'm going to have to dig into this one. I'm going to have to dig into this one. Although I appreciate the retweets of AARP. So this means I guess I'm going to have to start following myself. I guess.
Is that a thing? Can you do that?
I think I can. I think it's just wow. It's happening right now.
That's meta. There he is, John Lindemann. We're so happy to have you back.
Hey, it's good to be back.
I've missed you, John. Hey. You don't know how many times over the past 5 episodes I've cut out an awkward silence thinking, God, I could have used with homoerotic joke there. So don't let me down.
I won't. I'll work long and hard to get those homoerotic jokes in there, Greg.
Oh, yes! There it is! Boom! Right in. Booyah! First opportunity.
And of course, you're also hearing the voices of James Jones.
Yes.
And Greg Leahy.
Ahoy, ahoy.
I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, and we are back together again. John, sing the song.
Reunited, and it feels so good.
No, it does. Oh. It sounds awful.
I know, it's like soothing nectar pouring down your ear hole.
Soothing hot nectar.
It's ear candy.
I try.
All right, folks. We do talk about video games on this show. I'm not sure that John will, but John, tell us about whatever the hell has been going on with you for the past 6 weeks or so. Anything tangentially related to gaming would be preferable.
Yeah, I never quite got through Chrono Trigger. Let me just get that right out of the way.
But not quite got through, do you mean you put it in a box 6 weeks ago and haven't seen it since?
Actually, not a box, but my backpack, and it really never even came out. Because
a crate.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to play DS when you're driving.
I'm sure it's been done, but I wouldn't recommend it.
Well, apparently, I mean, it looks like, you know, looking at Twitter, it looks like, you know, I'm tweeting while I'm driving, apparently.
You did.
with a lot of AARP retweets, but...
It's important message to people your age about aging gracefully in a community such as your hometown of
Oh my god.
All right. James Jones aside. So big relocation to the Boston area. I got a new job up here. So I got relocated. So, and all of that happened within a month. So if you can picture everything that you're doing right now, picking up everything and moving it 1,000 miles away from, you know, Atlanta where I was to Boston, that's pretty much what I had to do. So in a 3 week, actually a span of even less than a month, because it was a span of 3 weekends where the first weekend we went kind of apartment hunting. We flew up to Boston, went apartment hunting. And then the next weekend we had to start packing. And then the next weekend we had to actually move. And then shortly after that, we drove all the way up here. So it's just been a crazy amount of activity crammed into one little area of life. So, I mean, right now, I mean, the way it stands right now, I mean, of course, you know, the first thing I had to, you know, hook up with it was a PC. But I found that I have an HDMI switch that I was... because I run everything through one monitor, so I had an HDMI switch, and that somehow got fried during the trip, so I don't have my 360 or PS3.
It was all that static it exposed to those plastic-wrapped games.
Yeah, it must be. It must be those things rubbing together in the boxes. It's just, you know, it blows stuff up, but I'm not really back in the swing of things yet, and, you know, the apartment's still a mess and everything. But
of course, Wii doesn't have HDMI.
This is true. This is true. I have it hooked
but
up in the other room.
You have to have Wii games.
That's the thing. When you make a move like this, you just kind of get out of your routine in several ways. And, you know, I'm not totally comfortable in the new place yet. Still kind of adjusting, but it's good.
So what have you played, if anything?
The last thing I really played of any significance was I did beat God of War Chains of Olympus, and I know that nobody will care about that at all, but...
Wait, is this the new one or the...
No, it's the old one.
This is the old one. And the funny thing is, and I think I know James will appreciate this, because I knew I was very close to the end in that game with my save game file. And so I loaded it up. I was like, okay, I had a feeling I was on the last boss, and it turns out I was on the last boss. But I believe the last save game file was like a year and a half ago. So literally been on the last boss for a year and a half.
Awesome.
And so I finally beat. Actually, I was just about to kind of pack it up and, you know, throw it in the backpack for the trip. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to sit here because I'd just been, you know, running myself to the ground packing stuff because we had to pack everything in a whole week, in just 1 week. And so, so I decided to throw it in and I finally beat it. Finally. So that was my Chrono Trigger. I was as good as I could do.
That was your Chrono Trigger?
Yeah.
It does feel nice to actually complete a game. Doesn't it?
Yes.
Even when that game is 3 hours long.
Yeah. I'm probably not the authority on it anymore, but yeah.
John, I can't even make fun of this. I mean, you spent a year and a half on a 3 hour game.
Yeah. Well, it's very similar to Mass Effect, where I was like, you know what, I'm gonna start playing Mass Effect again, and I realized that my save game was 2 years prior.
Jesus.
Like on launch day, right? If I remember correctly. It was the week it came out was the last time you played it.
Yeah, with that one, I bought it. I didn't play it like that day, but about 2 days afterwards, I put an hour into it and never touched it again.
Awesome.
2 years later, I pick it up. I'm like, oh, wow, maybe I should play this.
It's tough being a grown-up trying to play video games sometimes.
It's tough moving 1,000 miles and trying to do anything, really.
Oh, yeah.
That's no excuse for the last two games.
Hey, it's my excuse. I'm sticking to it.
Of course, we will look forward to you getting back into your routine a little bit, having some new stuff to talk about, but we're very glad to have you back. Did you, in your process of packing things up and unpacking them, did you come across any games that, you know, that had just been lying around that made you think, any kind of moments like that where you're just kind of piling things into boxes? Or?
Well, let me tell you, I am sick of moving games around. I have so many damn games. I have hundreds and hundreds of games. And see, the thing is, it's funny, right? Because I'm like old and grizzled now. So, but you know, when you're in your 20s, you know, you get your first job, you got some money and you can go out and, you know, you buy a bunch of games and you kind of marvel at your game collection, right? But then when you actually, and you really don't care because, you know, you typically you're living in some crap apartment and you don't really have a whole lot of meaningful stuff anyways. But once you start to kind of accumulate stuff, you have to pack all of those 200 and something games, and especially when you're buying stuff like, you know, I don't know if you know, but I kind of like to buy the collector's versions of certain games, right?
Come on, you got to tell me. You must have thrown something out.
Tell me you did. I don't actually, my wife gave me a hard time about this. I don't think I really threw, I don't think I got rid of any games.
So what'd you do? Stick the little Big Daddy figure on the top of the dashboard for the journey or something?
It'll keep you safe like a bobblehead Jesus.
I tossed some stuff, but it was nothing really to do with gaming. But you know what the worst thing is? My biggest regret is the cat helmet Halo 3 Legendary Pack, because I literally, that thing is like, it's like a kick in the gut. Every time I have to do anything and move anywhere or do anything like that, I have to pack up that stupid Master Chief helmet.
You don't have to. You can just get rid of it. You can burn it.
I have to.
Return of the Jedi.
I gotta get rid of it. I mean, I have to.
It's the perfect candy dish for your new place.
And that's the thing. It's so horrible. My wife is like, just trust me, my wife would love to see that thing run over by an 18-wheeler because she hates it.
You don't even like the game.
It's okay. I mean, I know it's the, but yeah, I kind of hate the game. It kind of sucks.
John
I'm not gonna lie.
John is angling for every person on staff to send him a cat helmet off of eBay.
But he has an emotional attachment to the helmet itself.
It just, I don't know.
I know we had a question about this in some shows, but you imagine if Nintendo did do collector's editions, just how much worse.
I'm glad they don't, you know? Like, I mean, I'm glad that I can get away with, you know, buying something like, you know, Metroid Prime Trilogy purely out of guilt. And it's just a steel box.
Yeah, it actually is exactly the same dimensions as a normal Wii case.
Yeah.
It fits into the lineup. I mean, it stands out, but it's no harder to transport or store than anything else. I like that kind of thing. And I don't know, this is where I come in, is that I don't like the clutter. I don't really like having stacks and stacks and stacks of games, because that's when I lose shit. I've got games that I've lost. I don't know where they are, just because they're on these small cartridges and or discs, you know, and they just pile up in places, and one of them falls off in the back, and then you never see it again.
Yep.
I know people always talk about how, you know, they can't stand the idea of, like, purely digital distribution future for gaming, where you don't have these physical copies anymore, you don't have the cases, you can't throw them up on the bookshelf. It's like, does anyone really miss having stacks and stacks and stacks of CDs?
Yeah.
I mean, that culture is pretty much gone now, I think.
Yep.
We probably still, you've still got your vinyl aficionados.
Yeah,
whatever,
sure. And I get that, but that's really a separate market. That is not a meat and potatoes thing. And I mean, music is almost purely digital now. And doesn't everybody like it better that way? I do.
Yeah, I do.
I do. I hate CDs. Although CDs are worse, because I have a special hatred for jewel cases. So game boxes are actually a lot easier for me to put up with, but still, I don't want all these damn Wii cases. I look at my shelf the other day and I realize I've got like 20, 25 Wii games stacked up, and I would prefer that they're all on the system. I mean, portable. I want to be able to move them from one system to another. But, man, I could do without all those damn discs.
I mean, all that stuff is cool until you have to move it. And then it just becomes like, wow, I just really want to get rid of
like
all this
books.
Stuff.
It's like people love having this bookshelf that shows off how intelligent they are and how cultured they are and shit. But then, have you ever moved books? Fucking hell.
Yeah, it's like moving an anvil.
It's the worst, man.
What?
I'm like, you know, there's this place called the library where I can go and get books for free. And when I'm done with them, I take it back and I never have to look at it again. And if I want to reread it, I just go back to the library and check it out again for free again.
You know, I thought of you, Johnny, because I was like, you know, Johnny, he always talks about Gamefly. And I was kind of like, eh, I'm not really interested in Gamefly. But after this move, I'm like, man, Gamefly is looking real good right now.
When it's not going to be a problem again for ages. You know, that's rational.
You know, I get to play all these mid-tier games with Gamefly. It's stuff that, like, I might spend full price on, but probably not. But I'm kind of curious about it.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. When I'm done with it, I send it back.
Yeah, I have a lot of older games too, like stuff like all my GameCube collection, which is cool in theory, but I won't play those games again. You know, I won't play those games again.
I believe you, John. You really don't have to reassert that.
But you know, I could also say that I'm not going to play. Let's grab random. Let's see, because I still have some Xbox games. I'm probably not going to play Hulk Ultimate Destruction for Xbox ever again in my entire life, or Sega GT 2002, Alien Hominid. Probably not going to play that again. Just a wild guess.
Alien Hominid is available on Live Arcade now. So if you ever wanted to play it again, you could grab it for $10.
I think there's going to be a culling of the herd at some point.
That's good.
Let's not do it when it was the most logical time to do it.
I know. That's the whole thing. It's so funny because I've been avoiding this stuff for years.
To be fair, he probably just didn't have time. I mean, that kind of process, if you really care about this stuff, that could take a while.
Yeah.
Could take a lot of thought.
That's exactly it, yeah. I mean, really, we only had days to plan the move, so.
All right. Well, we got to move on with new business. I have actual individual games to discuss here, so.
Oh, boy.
Starting off with BitTrip Fate, which just came out this week. It's brand new. I really like the BitTrip series. I didn't know a whole lot about this game beforehand, but I was looking forward to it. I always look forward to the new releases. And if you haven't seen a video, it's worth, you know, go to YouTube or our website or whatever. Find a video of BitTrip Fate, because it's a little bit difficult to describe. Basically, it's a side-scrolling shoot-em-up in which your character doesn't have free range of motion. There's a track that goes through the level, and you can only move along this track. So the track will swoop up and down. Sometimes it has like, it looks kind of like an audio waveform. Sometimes it sort of zigzags. Sometimes it just kind of makes like right angles or whatever. But it's on this track, so it follows this pattern. And so you can only move basically in one dimension, basically left or right or up or down. It depends on which way the track goes. In a lot of cases, in fact, most of the time, the track is at some angle, so it's not perfectly horizontal or vertical. And that is when the game's really interesting, because when the track is sort of diagonal like that, and you've got enemies shooting at you, and you're trying to shoot at them as well, your movement is always coupled. So you push left or right on the joystick on your nunchuck or on the classic controller, but Commander Video moves not just left or right, but also up and down coupled with that. And that makes it really tricky to predict where he's going to end up when you let go of the joystick, basically. So it ends up being kind of a bullet hell shooter in which the movement is pretty difficult to master. You can't just move it wherever you want. And so it adds a layer of difficulty in a genre that I'm not sure really needed another layer of difficulty, quite frankly.
Do you find it brings structure to it as well, though? Because sometimes, you know, yes, with those sorts of games, it's like, oh, I'm all over the place all the time. It's all just kind of crazy. And, you know, it's a bit hyperactive and rhythmless and kind of formless. I imagine that was probably what they were going for.
It's funny you use some of those words, because the game is still kind of rhythmless.
Ah.
And that's
interesting
one of my...
thing to say about a bit trip game.
I know. And that's one of my big criticisms of it. For one thing, I don't like the music. It's very... I mean, it's still electronic music, as you would expect with the series, but it's very slow. It's more like dubstep, you know, than techno or house that you've heard in some of the other ones. And it's certainly a lot more subdued than in Runner. I love the music in Runner. I mean, in that game, it feels like you're making the music. You're basically playing a note chart in Bit Trip Runner. It's abstracted, yeah, but you're basically playing a note chart. In Fate, it feels like the gameplay and the music are really divorced. Right. There's not very much interaction at all. The only thing is that the enemies might come in on the beat, but there's so many enemies and the beat is so slow that doesn't really make the connection that you would want. And the only time that anything you do makes a sound in the music is when you kill an enemy. But the problem is enemies don't die in one hit. So that's not, and plus your shots have a travel time from when you shoot out to when the enemy gets hit anyway. But most of the enemies take several bullets to kill depending on your upgrades at the time. And so it's not really something you feel like you're in control of. You know, it doesn't really have that connection between your ears and your brain and your fingers. Like, and all the other Bit Trip games do a really great job of that. Even the ones I don't care for very much, like Core, it still has a really, really strong connection between what you see and what you play and what you hear. And that's just not in this game. It's really lacking in that respect. What I do really like about the game is just what you said. There is more structure to it because of this track going through the level. It means that there's a lot more actual level design in this than you typically get in a shoot 'em up. Because in shoot 'em ups are usually just these wide corridors, and you can move anywhere inside of them, and enemies just dump into them. And the only design to it really is the patterns of the enemies. And some games do that really well. Some do it very poorly. But usually that's the main element of design in a shoot 'em up game. And in this, you've still got enemies coming in certain patterns and throwing certain bullet patterns at you that you have to dodge through. But you've also got this track layout. And the weird thing about it is that basically your movement, you know, the direction in which you move changes depending on where you are along this track. So that definitely makes it very interesting and makes it more challenging. And I like that idea. I don't know that it takes advantage of it as well as it could, but it does definitely make it feel different from other shoot 'em ups. I think the main problem is it's just slow. It's very slow. The game, it auto-scrolls. I think it probably has to because it has this track that you're moving along. But the game auto-scrolls, and it does so really at a very slow pace. The enemies enter the screen at a very slow pace most of the time. It seems like it takes too long to kill the enemies usually. It is reminiscent of Comic Jumper in some unfortunate ways, just in terms of the pacing and the bullet sponginess of the enemies. And
it's curious because I would have thought, because they've gone for the pointer control for aiming, I would have thought you could have hypothetically dispatched with enemies very rapidly using that more fluid interface and therefore kept the game at a reasonable pace.
Yeah, but the shooting doesn't work the way you probably think. It's not like Duck Hunt where you point at somewhere on the screen and shoot and it dies. It's not even like Sin and Punishment in that way. It's more like a twin-stick shooter, because you have to remember, this is still a 2D game. It's on a 2D plane. And so basically, it's more like Geometry Wars Galaxies, where you point somewhere on the screen, and that's basically determines the angle that your shots come out at. And that's why I was really, I figured the classic controller mode would be terrible, but I kind of just wanted to try it before the show just so I could say something about it. I actually think it works better than the pointer control, because this is basically, it's a really weird version of a twin stick shooter, but the way the shooting works, that's basically a correct description of it. So All you're doing is choosing the angle that the shots come out of Commander Video, and so it works just as well with the joystick as it does a pointer. In fact, I think it's easier with the classic controller, just because when you have the pointer up, that's a very different motion from what you're doing with the joystick, and so it feels like you're kind of doing two things at once. You know, two very different things at once. Plus, you've got more shit on the screen because you've got this cursor. It has to show you where you're pointing. And when you play with the class controller, there's no cursor, so the screen is a little more open and easier to see. And both of your thumbs are doing basically the same thing. They're just moving joysticks around. So it's actually easier. I actually got past a boss that I'd been stuck on by playing with the class controller. So I think it actually is the easier way to play. Anyway, it's $8. It's cheaper than BitTrip Runner.
I thought no Runner was $8 as well. The first three were $600, and now
you're right.
Runner and Fight are $800.
You're right. It doesn't feel like as good of a value as Runner. I beat the first three stages on my first try, so that's like 30 minutes right there, and I'm halfway through the game.
Mm.
The fourth level took me a couple of tries. I got through that pretty quickly. The fifth level hung me up for a little bit, and now I'm on the sixth and final level, and I've gotten to the boss. I can easily get to the boss, it's just the boss is really hard. And so I don't feel like there's as much content in this one. I mean, Runner is not, it's not like it's a massive game, but it's so hard.
No.
You have to replay bits of it so much that it lasts you. I mean, it took me a month to get through Runner, and in this, I'm going to have beaten it in basically a matter of about 3 hours or less. So I just don't feel like it's as good of a value, and it's just not as much fun to me. I'm really disappointed. I thought it would turn out better than this. I think it's a really cool idea mechanically, but it's not executed all that well. And the soundtrack is definitely a, you know, these are rhythm games. When the soundtrack's not that great, it's a problem.
Mm.
So, yeah, it's a disappointment. I don't know what they're going to go, where they're going to do with the sixth game in the series, but I'm hoping it's a little more visceral, to use a cliche. Something that feels a little more immediate when you play it, you know? Something that really feels like you're connecting with the music and the graphics a little better than this. This is a little disconnected for me. The other game, I'll talk about this quickly, is Alan Wake. This is the Xbox exclusive game that came out earlier this year. And it's from the guys who made Max Payne, and I've never played Max Payne, so I can't compare it. You know, I didn't really have any expectations for this. And Alan Wake is basically a third-person shooter. It's got an interesting setting. It's set in the Pacific Northwest. I think it's actually in Washington State. And it's kind of out in the middle of nowhere. It's out in the woods. The environment is really attractive. It takes place mostly at night, so there's a lot of darkness for sure. But there's also a lot of green, because you're walking through these very lush forests. And I like it aesthetically. Gameplay-wise, it's not very interesting. You're just, it plays pretty much like a Gears of War or Uncharted or whatever, in that you're basically just walking around slowly, and these sort of possessed guys come out, and they scream things at you in funny language. And it's very, BioShock is also another good example. Just the way the enemies are, you can't really tell what they're saying. You don't really know why they're attacking you. They just kind of jump out of nowhere and just kind of claw at you or throw pickaxes at you. And you have to shine a flashlight on them for a few seconds until they look more human, and then you can shoot them with your gun.
I felt sure then you were going to say you could suck them up in your vacuum cleaner.
That would have been more interesting.
So, yeah, I thought it would have been more original than that.
Yeah, no, gameplay-wise, it's actually very derivative of Resident Evil 4. Of course, it doesn't feel as good because you're using joysticks. I mean,
back when they started development, Resident Evil 4 was the new shit on the scene. So, yeah, you know, it kind of makes sense.
Well, you know, I think it doesn't have as much variety as Resident Evil 4. You know, the enemies all feel pretty much the same, and the way you kill them is pretty much the same. The environments are all pretty much the same. And I think it's just meant to be really immersive, but it's kind of not.
Mm.
It's not a bad game, but it's not very interesting to me. And the story, it's meant to come off as like a Stephen King novel, or maybe even Twin Peaks. The problem is Twin Peaks is funny and weird, and it's lacking that.
It's also 20 years old. I do wonder how many people this will resonate with at this point.
And it has, oddly enough, Alan Wake is the main character, of course, and he's a writer, and he's telling the story, and it's basically you kind of figure out early on that he's basically in a story of his own device, you know. The problem is he's kind of a bad writer, like in a really schlocky version of Stephen King, and Stephen King can be pretty schlocky sometimes, but he's really not a good writer, and the game has a lot of voiceover narration in which he's describing what you've already seen on the screen in a really, I don't like the voice actor very much. He sounds like a voice actor, and the narration that he's providing is so, it reminds me of Other M. It's like you see characters doing things on the screen, and then comes this voiceover where he tells you exactly what you just saw. It's pointless. It's fucking pointless.
Is it meant to be comedic, like, in terms of, like, here's what happened now, here's his, like, kind of bullshitty writer interpretation of it, or is there not enough of a difference between?
No, it is really deadpan, literal narration of what exactly is happening.
Right.
It's like he walks into the cabin, and it's kind of creepy, and there's some noises over there that you're not sure what it's making, and Alan Wake comes on the voiceover and says, "I walked into the cabin. It was really creepy. There were some strange noises coming from the corner." And I'm like, no fucking shit. What is the point? It's like they got this actor into the voice studio and had a whole week with him, and they finished all his main lines in the first 3 days, and they said, "Well, we got him for the rest of the week. What do we do?"
What if you had no basis for judging what a strange sound was?
You know, it would be great if you were blind and you were playing this game.
What if you are?
It's really strange. It's almost like subtitles for the literal action on the screen. I don't understand why they thought this was necessary. And his voice is very annoying to me, so it's just a major turnoff. Major. I don't think you can disable that feature either. I mean, it's sort of part of the conceit of the entire game, so.
Yeah.
I don't think I'm going to finish this one. It's not very impressive to me, and it makes me not want to go back and ever play Max Payne.
I don't think Max Payne is so concerned with the dialogue as much as it is with shooting shit a lot.
That might be better, yeah.
I mean, for God's sakes, his name is Max fucking Payne, yeah. Honestly.
Alan Wake is not much better.
A-Wake, yeah.
And it was, I mean, it was really sold as kind of the second coming, like some sort of huge story-driven...
It's not.
For it to turn out so average is just really disappointing.
It's really well made. It's the production values are nice on it, but yeah. I just don't see why they bothered. I don't really see what the creative spark is here that would make this game worth developing for 4 years. Mm-hmm. It's just what it's strange. So the last new game that I've played this week, actually played a lot more Super Meat Boy, and that game is evil and really addictive, in kind of a frightening degree. And I also am sort of slowly continuing through Kirby. I got to play a little bit of co-op, and that was fun. But I also, for the first time, started missing treasures when I was playing co-op. Because there's just more going on, you know, you're talking to each other, you know, one person's kind of running off in this direction, you kind of wanted to go up and check this place out, maybe there's something up there, but no, we gotta move on. So, I've actually had to go back through a couple of levels that we played as during co-op by myself so I can get all the stuff we missed. So, it may not be as productive in terms of completing the game, but it was fun for sure. But the other new thing I've played this week is Rock Band 3, which also just came out. And I don't have much to say about it because, as I think I mentioned before, I'm waiting for the MIDI adapter to play keyboards because I already have a keyboard. And I've ordered that, but it doesn't come out until like November 26th or something ridiculous. So as it is, Rock Band 3 is kind of like Rock Band 2, but with new songs. So I've played some of it, and I'm enjoying it, but I don't really have anything else to say about it because, you know, I don't have any of the new instruments or anything like that. But it seems to be, you know, really well done. There's some nice interface improvements and stuff like that, but I'm probably the worst person to talk about Rock Band 3 right now because I'm playing it exactly as I would Rock Band or Rock Band 2.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to hear about Rock Band 3, you might want to go on Twitter, and there's a guy named Striker Obi who you might want to start following.
Don't do that. You'll get to hear about lots of other unrelated things you don't give a damn about.
Or, you know, listen to the newscast, because those guys have been playing it. They can tell you about the keyboards and all that crap. I cannot. I wish I could, but I cannot right now. So in a month, we'll come back, and I'll tell you about how awesome Rock Band 3 is. All right, enough from me. So, James, what is there to say about Sengoku Basara Samurai Heroes that hasn't already been said about the terrible Samurai Warriors 3 that was released last month for Wii?
Well, did anybody here watch the YouTube link?
I did. I didn't understand it, but I watched it.
So if you could describe in a word or two what you saw from the opening cinematic of the game.
Mental. It reminded me a little of the intro to Fellowship of the Ring when they're in that big battle scene and the guy puts on the ring and it just kind of mows over all the armies. And yeah, that's what I remember, is like these giant battle scenes and like waves of energy and colors and shit knocking people over.
There's a lot less color at the start of Fellowship than this. This is pretty wild.
I equate this more to like an acid trip.
Yeah.
So, Sengoku Basara is essentially a game set in feudal Japan that is almost identical, structurally at least, to the various Koei series, Dynasty Warriors, Samurai Warriors, etc. Uh-huh. That functionally is pretty much the same, but with way more drugs involved.
So this is from Capcom.
Yes, which explains a great deal of what happened here. Mm. The video that I'm discussing with them is the opening sequence that plays before you get to the main menu that most games have.
Most Japanese games have.
Yeah. I have never skipped it, ever, because it's just too amazing. Basically, it goes through about 12 hyper-powered characters that just mow down thousands of enemies before running into each other with various explosions. It's awesomely stupid. That's the best way of describing this game. When I have to review this game, I will end up giving it a higher score because it just crosses the stupid scale so far that it becomes funny.
See, I was going to say, because the biggest complaint I hear about this is just that, you know, you're fighting all these guys and they're all complete idiots.
they're hapless.
They have no artificial intelligence, whatever. And I was going to say, well, would it be better if it was not feudal Japan themed and you were fighting like monsters or something, or zombies, which are very popular these days, you know, just mm-hmm. to rationalize the fact that they're complete idiots? But it sounds to me like it's gone the other way with you, and that the fact that they're people now makes it ironic and funny and more entertaining.
So for reference, all the characters in this game, all the characters you can play as, and there are actually quite a bunch of them you can play as, they all have their own whacked-ass story that they go through. But they're all actually, like, real people that really happened.
Yeah, historical figures.
Only, like, replaced with, oh, I don't know what the best word for it is, midriff-wearing psychopaths.
Yeah, I'm just watching the trailer in the background, James. It's quite epic.
Yeah.
A lot of spiky hair and people punching the ground and waves of energy coming off of them.
I told you, waves of energy.
Yep.
That shit happens in the game. And it's everything about the game is completely insane. You will kill about 800 completely mindless enemies hacking your way to whatever other feudal lord you're there to execute, and then you will have essentially a battle of the two of you beating the living crap out of each other with the occasional ridiculous explosion and them yelling dialogue at each other that makes no sense. It's almost unwatchable, but at the same time, you can't take your eyes off it.
Is it just wacky aesthetics propping up really bland gameplay?
Pretty much. And it's so wacky that it almost works.
Almost.
Almost. So, like one of the characters, I've played through two story modes now, and one of them, basically his driving motivation is to kill the person that killed his former master.
So he's a ronin.
Not exactly, because he seized control of what was left of his former lord's territory.
Yeah, he's like every character from Tekken ever.
Yes, essentially. only he's a real person that they went and turned into an emo bastard. When you finally kill this guy, they then have a cinematic of him yelling at him to stand up so he can kill him again for like a minute, and then finally you realize he's crying that this guy's dead, and mascara starts to run down his face.
Oh my god. Are you serious?
Yes. It is. Yes.
He has a Tammy Faye moment.
It is fucking unbelievable.
On the feudal battlefield.
I was just dying with laughter while I was watching it. And, I mean, there's a character who, he's very androgynous. They say him, but he's got a female voice actor and such. His inspiration was a daimyo in Shikoku who adopted Christianity during the Sengoku era until it became outlawed and he was summarily forced to abandon it. They can't use Christianity in there because of the things they do to the religion, so they've replaced it with this made-up religion called Zavism, where basically his minister, who's talking the entire time while you're trying to kill him, his minister is just jabbering on about going through the rules of Zavism and forgetting what they are and replacing them with statements about you have to give them money. But when you finally... like, when you get to places, like, people will come to fight you, and it'll, like, show this dialogue of this lord talking to her subordinates, or his subordinates, calling them by the Christian names that they've been assigned, like Happiness Tree, and other things.
Happiness Tree.
Okay. And, like, text will appear in, like, this bubbly font when they stop to introduce them. Zavism welcomes you, while a guy with a chainsaw and electricity is coming out of his hands ready to kill you. It's completely fucked. It makes no sense. And it's just so over the top that I just can't not love it.
So how's it compared to No More Heroes? That's what I'm thinking right now.
Yeah.
The gameplay itself is so... it's actually, there's a lot like No More Heroes. Unlike a lot of the Dynasty Warrior games, which tend to have big open areas where you just killed a lot of things, these are much more like level, so like there's a path you have to follow to the end of the level.
Mm.
That does make it sound like No More Heroes.
Yeah, it's a bit like No More Heroes, but where in No More Heroes you might kill 100 guys. I had a mission before we recorded where I killed 500, and that's not really all that unusual. The game itself actually says you KO'd that many people because if you killed 6,000 people by yourself, you would be like one of the greatest mass murderers of all time. So it's a bit much. But the game actually, you know, you level up your character based on how many war crimes you've perpetrated, essentially. Basically set against this completely asinine story with these characters that make no sense and do crazy things like summon wood that they sleep in. Or a guy that built a city on the water and has mirrors that he uses to reflect the sun as a weapon. I mean, it's just completely asinine. Oh, and of course, you saw in the trailer, a big fucking robot / samurai.
Obviously. Does it seem like the localizers are in on the joke?
Oh yeah, they're totally in
on the
joke.
They're amplifying it, maybe even?
When Capcom made the series, they went with the very Capcom approach of, we can make a lot of these quickly, we can make toys out of it, we can make Gunpla out of it, we can make a TV series and a manga out of it. And there's a pretty famous YouTube clip from the show, one of the characters, the character I actually played with first. He's riding on a horse with exhaust pipes sticking out of it, while his men are riding behind him in various states of combat dress. He asks, and I'm going to try to do the voice as best I can, "Are you ready, guys?" And they all respond, "Yeah!" And he responds with the following phrase, "Put ya guns on." And they all start cheering. And it's just so... It perfectly describes how fucking messed up this game is. And that's why it's actually playable. Hmm. The fact they actually support the classic controller and they even use the extra buttons for the Pro, that's great. But the fact this game was made by people on drugs is really what sells it.
All right. Well, it's worked for other games.
I can play it much longer than I should be able to, simply because I'm like, all right, what crazy bullshittery is this character going to have in their story?
You're making me think of Nobi Nobi Boy, which I actually busted out this past weekend. I had a friend over, and I just felt like, I want to show you this game. We were going through a bunch of weird games, and I pulled that out, and I just put the controller in his hand. And I said, "Here, play it. You're automatically as good at this as anyone in the world." And he lost his shit at that game, and I told him, and we were just cracking up. And I said, "You know, honestly, if I went to someone's house, I'd never heard of this before, and they showed it to me, I would probably think I was hallucinating." So I know how you feel right now, but this is real.
The thing is, the gameplay itself is pretty generic, but it's right. Everything they build on it, you're like, what? Like, the first time I fought the boss, who is the manifestation of this Christian-adopting daimyo, she rides around on heads that she has made in the image of her god and shoots missiles out of its eyes.
All right, so James is enjoying Sengoku Basara.
I feel like the entire review can just be that opening video and just be like, that happens. The end. And of course, what we didn't mention is the music that goes with it is completely fucked. It's just, it's some dude being auto-tuned, screaming lyrics in English that make no sense.
Oh, man. Auto-tuning. I didn't see that one coming, actually. Does he say, they're climbing in your windows? No. Didn't do that.
No.
All right, Greg, bring it home.
Hide your kids, hide your wife.
By the way, John, I know you're off your game this week. I know you're coming back into it slowly, because when James said summon wood, Greg is the only one who giggled.
Hey, come on. I've been trying to be more mature here.
The RPG alternative to Viagra.
That was a softball. Come on.
He's setting you up, John. He's been thinking about this for a while.
Maybe we should give John the aluminum bats.
I think John needs to go back in the walking boot for a while. So yeah, this week, unfortunately, Kirby did not arrive in time for me to get quality time. I'm quite sad about that. I was very much looking forward to playing that for a while. So in lieu of that, I went back and played some more Wario Land Shake It for the first time in quite a while. And I've had like 86% of the treasures. Mm-hmm. And I'm now at 97. I'm in touching distance of getting them all. It was cool the way I could just kind of go straight back into it, some of these levels, and, you know, obviously some of the more obscure treasures because I hadn't got them before. Some really cool puzzles in some cases involving like being set on fire and stuff like that. So, yeah, I mean, it is such a good game. It kind of reaffirmed for me that it, as of now, it's kind of my favourite side-scroller of the, you know, number of laudable ones that there are on Wii at the minute. And so Kirby and Donkey Kong are both going to have to sort of aim for that kind of bar, because I think the level design is, especially of the secret levels, is just really good. The sort of backwards and forwards elements to it and all the different kinds of things you can go for. And I'm certainly not ever going to entertain the idea of doing all the missions. But, you know, sometimes with ones within sight, and you think, oh, you know, I could hit that coin target if I just do this, this, and this. It's fun to just do that. And
what about all the little achievements?
Yeah, that's what I mean by missions. Is the
ones, yeah. I couldn't remember if those were separate.
They're really quite diverse. You know, sometimes it's aiming for a certain coin score, which, you know, I guess is kind of similar to getting the medals in Kirby. But then other times it's weird crap, like just like find a golden enemy somewhere hidden in level, or like set off all the bomb blocks in a level, or, you know, sort of get through a whole level without touching the water and stuff. So yeah, but some of them you're probably never going to do, but other ones is just like, oh, I could do that if I tried. You know, it's just enough of a little incentive. I think the only stuff that you get for doing that is like the CDs in the sound test. Mm-hmm. Which is kind of more than you get for getting all the treasures, because I think all that does is like change Wario's room to all gold or something. Yeah. So not exactly a huge inducement, but I'm so close now, I think I will do it eventually. Although Kirby could come tomorrow and kind of throw a wrench in that. So we'll see. But this being that this episode will be going out on Halloween, it's perfect time to bring Castlevania Lords of Shadow back from the dead for my kind of wrap up on it. I've beaten the game now.
40 hours later.
It took me about 17 hours to beat it.
It doesn't seem that long, but for that kind of game, for one of these modern character action games, you know, which it's obviously patterned after God of War, Dante, or Devil May Cry, Dante's Inferno, that kind of stuff, 17 hours is really long.
I guess so. You know, again, I haven't played any of those sort of contemporaries to weigh it against. I mean, just my kind of gut feeling on it was not so much that it was too long per se, but just that start was too slow.
Uh-huh.
You know, it took too long to kind of get going, to introduce some of the wrinkles of the combat system that there are. There's a lot of stuff early on where it's like, okay, you get like a big kind of enemy, like a giant spider or something like that, and it's like, right, subdue it, mount it, break down this obstacle with it. You know, that's a lot of the rhythm of the early part of the game, and it feels quite slow. I mean, it does change quite a lot as you get in further to the game. I mean, chiefly the middle part of it is the part that you spend in the castle. And that's quite different, because that's where you get more of the puzzles.
And how do you deal with it? I mean, puzzles haven't really been a part of Castlevania games very much in the past. And they're not really a big part of these other, you know, third-person action games that I mentioned, so...
Yeah, again, that's why it kind of reminds me a bit of Darksiders. Yeah, because obviously that's got the Zelda thing going on.
So I never got that far in Darksiders, but when you say puzzles, I'm thinking like Resident Evil stuff. like find this item and combine it with this other item and then turn the crank.
There is some of that, but then there's other stuff that is more like, you know, like you're operating some sort of mechanism, like a big toy puzzle. Or there's other ones, like I said, in the castle where you might get a succession of switching puzzles involving electrical fields or the sort of Frankenstein's laboratory part.
Is this the kind of stuff you'd see in Zelda?
See, here's the difference for me.
Is there any block pushing?
Not really. I can't really remember a lot of block pushing. I mean, the difference to me is this. It's something like Darksiders or Zelda. The puzzles tend to be contained in these dungeons. And the dungeons, they have like a sort of flourishing to them of the puzzle. So it's like you start with an introducing a concept and then you build off that concept and you get to eventually to like the most advanced puzzles in that dungeon will be really quite intricate, but they've kind of directed you towards being able to solve it by taking you through these kind of earlier incarnations of the concept. Mm-hmm. Here, apart from a few parts in the castle, as I say, where it seems to overtake the gameplay a little more, the puzzles are quite out of place. There'll just be one, all of a sudden, it's kind of got nothing to do with anything, and it's just there, and you have to solve it. Although you can, I think, like, forego, you know, like, the currency of the game to buy extra moves and stuff. You get rewards for solving the puzzle by yourself, but you can elect to simply forego that and keep playing. So they're kind of recognizing this a little bit extraneous to the main flow of the game there, because clearly they don't want people getting really frustrated. But I think the combination of some of them being very singular and also they're being very much out of the rest of the flow of the game means that sometimes they could be harder to solve than they kind of should be, because you haven't, you're not necessarily sure exactly what's expected of you. Mm-hmm. As you would be, as I said, when you've got that kind of introduction to concepts that you have in something like Zelda, where that isn't there, you could take a while to figure out what it wants you to do. But I mean, they're okay. They're kind of hit and miss. It is a nice change of pace again, because I think the action could get a bit monotonous. So certainly some of them add something to the game, and I think it's most successful when it is more structured and kind of cohesive in the middle part with the castle. But what I wanted to talk about was the bosses, because early in the game, that you fight these titans that apparently are like totally straight out of Shadow of the Colossus.
They're that big?
They are massive, massive, massive characters, like animated stone figures that you have to deactivate by attacking these flashing spots on they're kind of like a platform challenge, because you're climbing onto these.
That sounds a lot like Shadow of the Colossus.
Those fights I really didn't like at all. They're too slow. They were not exciting. They were tedious. It was just kind of like a trial and error thing for me, where, you know, it was like, okay, well, once you destroy this part, the Titan uses its one arm to kind of slap you, so you've got to dodge to the other side. But, you know, you might not get it the first time. So then you kind of have to go back to the beginning of the routine where, you know, you have to stun the boss by sending his attack back at him and then climb up again. And just too slow, too tedious. Didn't like it at all. Does this mean I'm going to hate Shadow of the Colossus? Because I'm really interested in picking that up with the TB code collection.
Not necessarily. Usually in that game, if you get knocked off, you'll just kind of fall to a lower part of the Colossus.
Right.
So I think it very rarely would make you go all the way back through a process just because you made a mistake. The other thing is, if you get knocked off, I mean, if you get some hits in on it and then get knocked off, it's not like those hits disappear.
No, well, it's not like that here, but it's just the whole process takes long enough that even though sometimes, like, you will have certain kind of shortcuts in that, you know, you're definitely not literally repeating everything you've done when you get back on the Titan, but it's enough repetition there that for me it was just like, this is not tense, this is not exciting, as lovely as it is to look at, I'm just not that into it. But then after that early part of the game, there are virtually no other bosses like that. There is one more towards the end, which I actually quite liked, because it was kind of like the culmination of the game's platforming, because it was really kind of an advanced platforming challenge, like on a creature where it was definitely, that was the most difficult to figure out, you know, what, where you couldn't hang on to this thing and jump to and all that. So I felt that kind of worked a bit more. You know, maybe some of the mistake was just having two of them close together early in the game. But most of the bosses aren't like that. And I enjoyed the vast majority of the bosses because, you know, it plays off the combat which is, you know, fundamentally sound very well. The only thing is the attack patterns that the bosses employ can be a bit samey over the course of the game. Some of them sort of, you know, it's like, yeah, this guy is doing some pretty similar things to the guy like three chapters ago or whatever. So you could have done with a bit more variety there, but in general, they are pretty satisfying. And I enjoyed the game quite a lot. It is, you know, again, I can't speak to what someone's experience would have been like if they'd played some of these, you know, contemporaries before, but on its own merits, it is, you know, as I said before, very, very attractive game and solid gameplay mechanics. So I certainly don't regret buying it, and you know, room for improvement, definitely, if supposedly they're already working on the sequel.
Oh, there already is. It's all but official.
This was a bit of a weird kind of project that they had to sell Konami on it pretty hard to even get it made. So if they've got more backing and more resources in the future, I think they could do something really quite exciting with it.
So you think it's better than Castlevania Judgment?
I haven't played that. I would not dare venture a verdict.
I've played enough of Judgment, which is to say 3 minutes at E3.
That's sad.
Yeah. All right, well, that's going to close out new business. Now we're going to take a break. When we come back, we have a whole bucket load of your listener mail, read by John Lindemann.
Yes, get ready.
Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
All right, this week, impressions, we have Donkey Kong Country Returns. Aaron takes yet another run through Retro's new platformer, and he'll definitely make you want it even more than you probably already do.
Mm-hmm.
I am encouraged.
And on the review front, Rock Band 3, kind of a combo review. Well, mostly Neil, but Carly also throws it in 2 cents. If you're a Rock Band fan, you probably already have Rock Band 3, but for those on the fence, is it for you? And how good is Pro Mode, really? Neil gives you all the answers with his review.
All right, in the interview space, we've got a Tron Evolution interview with InSpace, or what's left of it. We talked to Tim Schwalk and Mike Lee. I stole it. We talked to Tim Schwalk and Mike Lee, producers of the Wii and DS versions of Tron Evolution. They discussed the gameplay in both titles, how much freedom they had with the license, and what it was like developing a title for one of their favorite movies. Hey, it's not even out yet. How could it be their favorite? We also have a review of Super Scribblenauts from Zach, who looks at the
somewhat anticipated sequel.
And tells us how it stacks up to the original. Do the new puzzles and level creation tools put it over the top? Zach will clue you in.
On the blog front, we have Jam with the Professor Part 1. Here, James has embarked on an odyssey to adapt Professor Layton's theme in the creation tools of Jam with the Band. Find out if he pulled it off.
Great idea.
And the answer is no, but...
In a content deluge from Mr. Jones, we have his review of Sid Meier's Pirates. A striking departure from his usual diet of RPGs, James played the Wii port of Sid Meier's Swashbuckling Adventure. Is it worth your time on Nintendo system? His review gives you the load.
Once again, the answer is no. In the features front, we have more Flip's Twisted World with Happy Birthday Flip by Douglas Gregory.
By birthday, it's referring to the fact that Flip's Twisted World is now out.
Right. It was a release day look back on the different stages of the game's development lifecycle.
Yep.
And Andy has a review of NBA Jam. I'm not saying that. Andy takes an update of the original arcade classic for a spin, big head mode and all.
Boom shakalaka! Welcome back to the show! It's time for listener mail. The address is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. Please include a name or username that we may refer to you by, and a location. It's neat to see where everybody's coming from here. In celebration of John's return to the podcast, I've asked him to read all of the letters this week.
I have agreed.
It sounds more like punishment to me, but there you go.
I'm ready. I'm ready to do it.
He might do it in voices or in a freestyle rap type scenario.
Oh, dear God.
Matt from Lancaster, Pennsylvania.
Jesus.
Okay, yeah.
That is the most racist thing you've ever done on the show.
Matt from Lancaster, Pennsylvania writes, I was wondering if you've noticed the new trend in which retailers are cutting the number of games they carry. All the box stores I frequent have halved the games they carry in the last 6 months. This often skews the selection of Wii titles, leaving the majority Blue Ocean or licensed tomfoolery. Do you think this is contributing to the third-party sales problem on Wii?
James, you're the only person I know who actually buys games in stores.
That's unbelievable. But I can confirm that observation, that pretty much all retailers have culled the number of games they have on their shelves.
What about GameStop? I mean, that doesn't apply to them, does it?
They've done it too. I mean, they...
Why? What else do they have to sell?
Well, they spend more space on other stuff, like accoutrement and used titles, essentially.
Like guides?
Yeah, stuff like that. Things that have a higher profit margin than new games, which would be anything. Mm-hmm. And what you see if you look at, like, Wii sections is you see basically what he's said. You get a lot of shovelware, stuff that's come out in the last few months, and you get the occasional AAA title. Like, you can't find copies of some games that came out only a year plus ago. It might be difficult to find a copy of, I don't know, Sin and Punishment right now, new, at a big box retailer, because they have moved it off the shelf in place of Zobby's wonderful pinball machine.
I mean, Just Dance 2.
No. Well, yes, but no.
Well, I mean, can we really fault retailers for wanting to only stock the games that sell?
Well, it's not necessarily only the games that sell. It's that games get a very short window on the shelf unless they sell really, really well, and then they get booted. So if you go to Target, Targets are redesigning all of their game sections, and you'll see that they have a whole new layout. They've got this, like, big suggestion board of games. It's like a touchscreen TV, stuff like that.
Are they getting rid of the glass box?
Yes.
The lock and key.
Yes, they've gotten rid of those.
That has bothered me since I was a kid.
What they have right now, and my store got it really early in the game, is they've got the box of the game on this like sloping triangular rack, so it's on one side and the other. And the box of the game, you pull it down, and then there's copies of the games behind it. Hmm. So they're basically just stacked up behind it. So it's just a straight face of games. You pull it down, there's copies there. You can take one, go to the registers. Hmm. But that rack has less games on it than used to have in the glass cases, and stuff gets shuffled out quicker. Now, on the DS, you can see this even to an even more obvious degree, because right now, the DS landscape is bad stuff. Stuff that has no reason to be played. And if you go to, say, Best Buy, you'll find that their DS section is A, really small, and B, just total dreck.
Or really old games.
Yeah, stuff that they can't sell, because it's like, I don't know, Winnie the Pooh teaches DS typing. I mean, just horrible stuff.
I don't think that exists.
It might. Just stuff that nobody wants, or stuff that is cheap, or stuff that's new and is shovelware. So there are new games that are good on there, but they'll get shuffled out for the bad games too. And you can actually, when this was going on, you saw this a lot more clearly, because Best Buy, when they were sort of culling the herd, they had these big bins, and you could buy games that normally retail for decent amount of money for like $5. When I got my copy of The World Ends With You, I found it in one of those bins, and it was the first time I'd seen that game new in a long time. It was the bottom of a crate full of like AMF Bowling for Wii, which, as we recall, was a prize at the Retronauts panel.
Yeah. Good point.
And I'm not making it up. That was what it was under. It was a copy of AMF Bowling, and I almost bought both just because. And that started back in January, because that's how I found the copy of Tales of Symphonia Dawn of the New World was in one of those bins.
At Best Buy?
Yeah.
Maybe I should swing by there and see what I can
do. See, I think now, though, those bins are kind of they've kind of moved away from them, because they've culled everything.
They've been through the process. Yeah,
they've purged the stuff that they're not going to have on their shelves anymore. So now they have like one rack that's just discount stuff, and they basically just emptied the warehouse. There's Xbox games on there, like original fucking Xbox games, because they basically just said, we're just going to dump the warehouse out, and that's the end of it. Mm-hmm. And what you get is just some horrible stuff.
You know, I kind of hate buying games at brick-and-mortar stores. It's just always been a depressing experience for me. You know, like, The games I buy get weird looks from the sales clerks because I've never heard of them before, or because they're for Wii. I mean, I go to GameStop and I get weird looks from the guy because I bought a Wii game. It's like, dude, this has got to account for 50% of your sales.
Yeah, really.
Why do you think it's weird for a grown man to come in here and buy a Wii game? Even if it's something like, you know, not that I bought Sin and Punishment, but I bought stuff like that before. And
he stole
like,
it.
Why are you buying this? You know, it's like, what do you care?
Don't judge me.
I mean, trust me, I'm buying the best games on the system. I'm the guy who doesn't come in here and get Just Dance. I get the good shit that you never sell. Actually, that's one of the things is when I do rarely go into game stores, a lot of times the games I'm buying or that I'm looking for, the clerks never even heard of them.
Yeah.
It's like, I don't know if we have that. I'm like, look, just go look. You'll find it. I remember Katamari Damashii. That was like, the guy that was like, what? What language is that?
Yeah.
I was like, you have it. Go, look, I see it. It's on the shelf right there. Just give me that one. Here's $20.
There was a Wii game I played recently. Can't remember what it was, but it had a DS. It was a sequel to a DS game. I can't remember.
Trauma Team?
Yes. And he was convinced I meant Trauma Center. like convinced. Like, he could not be persuaded otherwise. I'm like, no, dude, it's a real game.
I need to play more Trauma Team.
I'm like, this is a real game. I've played it. I own a copy already. And he's like, well, then why do I need the copy? Just find the damn game. And their website said they had it in stock.
And going to a big box store like Best Buy is even worse because it feels literally like you're shoveling through piles.
Because you are.
Even to get brand new full price games, they're just like stacked on a shelf, like one in front of the other.
Yep.
I don't like it. I really dislike that process.
To be fair, the GameStop I got Trauma Team at is not the one I usually go to. And the one I usually go to, generally speaking, the staff is pretty good. You know, they don't do the whole, do you want to get the magazine spiel?
Yeah.
They kind of just, we're going to pass on that. Now, I do get the magazine, but that's irrelevant.
One thing I've been wondering about, though, with this situation of the retailers are kind of getting squeezed on their margins, they're getting more ruthless with shelf space, is what they're going to do to accommodate Move and Kinect. What gets cut to accommodate those on store shelves?
Both of those launching with like 15, 20 titles apiece.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, Move, in a lot of cases, the Move games are games that already existed. They're just being patched.
No, that Move launched with like 15 new games.
Oh.
Yeah, you got your Sports Champions and your Racket Sports.
Could they come up with the worst name?
Whatever other concept they can rip off.
Sports Champions.
A lot of light gun games, actually.
Yeah. So what I've seen basically is they just cut into the shelf space that was heretofore devoted to core titles for those systems.
Really? It's not like, well, this is more like Wii stuff, so we kind of, you know, it's a different market, so we're going to maybe cut into the Wii store shelf space instead?
They basically slashed the new shelves for the Xbox stuff when Kinect just had boxes. So when I came back from E3, I went to GameStop because I think I needed a new game. I don't remember. Like, I had money in hand. I was like, I'm going to buy a fucking game right now. It was because Sin and Punishment came out right after E3, didn't it?
It was close.
Pretty close.
Yeah, and I went in there, and this is definitely my first visit since E3, and we were talking about what I saw there, and they already had all this Kinect shelf space in escrow, essentially, with these fake Kinect boxes up there, and like the Kinectimals box just staring at me like 2 weeks later. And I'm like, dude, I saw this in person. Holy shit, why do you already have cardboard boxes for it?
And the really sad thing is they don't have enough shelf space for the actual games that they are selling in the store.
Yep.
And they're going to waste shelves on empty boxes of games that aren't coming out for 6 months.
They must get the money from Microsoft for that, surely.
Well, and it fuels their pre-order scam. So, I mean, luckily, if you go to a big box store where they don't do pre-orders, that's less of a problem, but it's prevalent at GameStop.
So here's how it went down, because I talked to him about it, because I was like, why do you already have this out? I mean, it's months away. And this is how he explained it to me. They watched the E3 press conference, because they had already started work. They watched it at work in there, on like one of those wireless network internet things that you get, like, get off the phone lines. Mm-hmm. Within a week, they had one of those shipments from corporate with advertising material in it, you know, like the big cardboard cutouts and stuff. Within that week was the Kinect stuff. So the Kinect conference was Sunday night, right? Mm-hmm. And then Monday was Microsoft's event. And I think he said like Friday they had stuff in store that they were told, put this on your shelves.
Sure.
And I was like, 4 days. How in the hell did you – it just blew my mind that in 4 days they had already put space in escrow for something that would come out months later. And Microsoft might be paying them, but famously Sony did pay when the PSP was trying to get a foothold against the second wave of the DS. Sony famously was paying GameStop for shelf space, knowing there was a fixed amount of shelf space. And even though there were way less PSP games than DS games, that's why PSP games had more shelf space if you went to a GameStop, because Sony paid per shelf. And Nintendo, being Nintendo, would never do that.
Hmm.
Eventually, that facade went away when they realized, wait, we can make money on DS games.
So Matt's question ended with, do you think this is contributing to the third-party sales problem on Wii? I think if James is right and this started around January, the third-party sales were a problem way before that on the Wii. I'm sure it's not helping, but we've discussed many times the roots of those problems. It's demographics, it's poor quality of early titles, which set up expectations for the market so that higher quality titles that came later had to deal with stereotypes and preconceived notions about what third-party software was like on the system.
Right.
A lot of it has to do with just the sheer overpowering reputation of Nintendo's first-party stuff, especially for mass market. I mean, there's always been a certain audience for games like Sin and Punishment, Trauma Team, you know, Monster Hunter, whatever else, but it's never really grown. I mean, that the market for that stuff has been on the Wii since day one. Those are the people who bought all the launch units, and they've bought that stuff all along, but it's never really grown because Nintendo didn't try to push growth in that area. They pushed growth in another area.
Well, and, you know, even the sort of the Excitebots example, I mean, that is a first-party game, but it may as well be one of the many forgotten third-party games or whatever, because it, you know, it didn't have the fanfare. And
you have to tell people that your game is coming out if you want them to buy it.
or in the case of Excitebots, that it exists.
And the retail situation definitely must feed into that. I mean, it's just one of many channels from which this sort of negative equilibrium was perpetuated.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, sort of, you know, especially now, made even worse, just that we get to a point where, you know, the retailers don't expect it to succeed, so they give it less of a chance, and then it's, you know, very much more likely that it won't succeed. I mean, you only tend to see that kind of bucked if you get Nintendo involved, and they do push something even beyond what they did with certain first-party titles, like maybe Sin and Punishment and Excitebots, with, say, something like Monster Hunter, where they did get involved. And they did kind of move the needle somewhat. I mean, that debuted, Monster Hunter Tri debuted in the top 10 in the UK charts.
I've heard Capcom say that they were very happy with how it sold.
There's no way that's happening without Nintendo's push. And some of that is online marketing and all that kind of stuff, but some of it is the interface with the retailers as well. So this phenomenon that's been described by Matt definitely is a contributing factor, but I wouldn't say it's a determining factor.
Those two probably feed into each other, though. I mean, retailers,
they do.
I mean, it's not worth our time to stock these games. And then, well, these games don't sell well, so it's not worth our time to stock these games. Well, I can't buy the game if you're not selling it.
It's an equilibrium position. You know, it just sustains itself.
I just think the funeral toll for third-party Wii games was in 2007.
I would push it to 2008.
If you want to fix that situation, you have to go back that far, because all the problems with it today, you can trace it back to that. Third-party games did fine on the Wii in 2006. It was in 2007 that the shit hit the fan. And all the companies dropped the ball, including Nintendo.
2006 had some garbage, though.
But sold.
Red Steel sold great.
No, I'm not counting Red.
That fucking Super Monkey Ball game sold great.
Comparatively to some of the shit that came out, Red Steel was gold.
It's launch window. There's going to be a lot.
We had all those Ubisoft games that were just ports of Xbox games that were broken.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Ubisoft should have been banned from the system for the shit they pulled.
We know how you feel about Ubisoft, James.
Yeah, okay, time to move on.
Their dev kit should have been seized.
John, could you read the next letter, please?
Paratosh writes, my question was related to Zelda Skyward Sword's release date. With the 3DS launching by the end of March 2011, and Skyward Sword set to release in early 2011, do you think Nintendo will delay Skyward Sword to the summer or fall? Not like they've ever delayed a Zelda game, right? Or do you guys think they'll release it around the same time, possibly having some tie-in with Ocarina of Time 3DS? Maybe if you finish Skyward Sword, something opens up in Ocarina, as Skyward is supposed to be before Ocarina.
What, you mean it's not coming out this year?
No, it isn't. My feeling is that if you want to kind of look for a precedent for this, look at Galaxy 2. That was finished in time to come out last year, but of course they had New Super Mario Bros. Wii ready. That was the big holiday game, and you certainly can't argue with that decision to let that take the prime time spot because it did so well in it. But then they didn't release Galaxy 2 in quarter one. They held it over to that sort of summer spot where the year before they had Wii Sports Resort.
So Greg, you're predicting May.
I'm thinking, May to June kind of time for this. It just, to me, I really strongly doubt that they're going to wedge it into that first quarter now, because it is so busy. I mean, it is not just busy for 3DS, it's busy for all the other systems. I mean, that looks like a very, very crowded field. There's a lot of games. So I think Zelda is a game where that matters more than in other games, because that is one game where people who might not use their Wii regularly would go back to it for Zelda, because it might be one of the cherished franchises, people that game primarily on 360 or PS3. So I still think it could hurt if you release it alongside all of those big HD games that are going to be coming out, because they just got bumped out of 2010, as seems to be kind of customary now.
Yeah, might make sense to prop it up like during the summer drought period.
I think for Nintendo, though, that there's not just a matter of how it will affect their sales, but I think they have a certain amount of... It has to capture a certain amount of mind share for them, just as a standard. Like, a Zelda game can't come out and not have significant mind share, or for Nintendo, that's a failure, regardless of how it sells.
Yeah,
it's kind of a brand tradition they have to hold in place. Now, also, nobody's seen this game in a long time. We don't know how far along it is at all. What we've seen are screenshots of some stuff that's been changed, but basically it's not...
What they keep telling us is that, actually a lot of the game is done, but it was the visual and the aesthetic stuff was the last to get finalized and all this stuff.
But you can't just say, it's just the visuals. We just have to tweak the graphics. I mean, because you have to recreate all your art assets.
It was a really backwards explanation that they were giving at E3
about that game. I do not foresee that they would now, having admitted defeat, that they can't get it out for holiday like they would have wanted to, are going to then rush it, to get it into that quarter one period.
They put it in what I referred to as the Mario Sunshine slot, which I remember when it came out, because it came out like 2 weeks before school started.
Yeah, it could be. I think it could be earlier than that. Like I said, the Galaxy sort of slot. They've hit it 2 years in a row. It seems like that's their time where they can release a big product. And, they can, obviously, they're going to reach out to their mainstream sort of appeal as they normally do, but they can also, at that time, kind of hold the attention of that certain part of the more core gamer kind of audience that is receptive to what Nintendo's doling out.
They're not going to release this game in Europe before Epic Yarn. Epic Yarn is going to get its time in the sun in Europe before this game.
And that's supposedly quarter one.
It could be out in January or February, though.
Well, I mean, they'll put a certain amount of distance through that DK, which is December here.
Not
so.
That they're doing that for us, but they'll do it for you guys.
A bit confounding why it's coming out there, but yeah, I do feel like the first quarter is highly, highly unlikely for Zelda in any territory apart from maybe Japan.
So, like, let's...
Majora's Mask was like April in Japan.
Yeah.
10 years ago.
And do you remember Twilight Princess was supposed to be released in April of 2006, and then it was delayed until Christmas?
Which I suppose is still not entirely out of the question that it could get delayed again.
Maybe they just want to have it at another E3.
But I don't... maybe, but...
If they've got any damn sense, they'll be selling a new console next Christmas.
Yeah, see, that's the thing. I just think that's too long to wait, to be honest. And I don't... If you look at the kinds of games that they've been hitting for holiday on Wii, I don't know that Zelda fits into it all that well anymore.
Yeah, they're more kind of mass market, aren't they?
Yeah, there's 2D side-scrollers
nostalgic.
Like DK... Yeah, I don't see it. So, I mean, I suppose it could go in the sort of Metroid slot, but maybe that's not prime time enough. So I would still go with summer.
I think what we need to make sure we keep in mind is where they have the distribution of their marketing assets, because when the 3DS does come out, that's their focus.
Yeah, exactly.
They will do nothing else. So
One more reason why the first quarter is not happening.
So there you go. There are our predictions. I'm going to say April. We'll see. All right, John, got the next letter?
Nathan from Toronto writes, what are your thoughts on video game magazines? I know many of us were heavy subscribers to the likes of Nintendo Power and EGM years ago, but with internet media and fan sites becoming so popular over the years, do you think game magazines have lost their relevance? Are they still needed? Do any of you subscribe to a particular magazine? Only when they're $5 on Amazon.
That's right. Well, I already answered the question just now, I guess, two questions ago.
It's gotten to where I've got a number of subscriptions to various different magazines. They're not all gaming related, but sometimes it takes me a while to get through them because I just don't, reading magazines is no longer part of my schedule, basically. And so it seems like I never put much time into it. But I get EGM now. I subscribed to that earlier in the year, and that's all. Mm-hmm. And I kind of enjoy it, but a lot of it is sort of outdated. I mean, I think the niche for magazines, if they're going to survive, is it has to be stuff that's not time sensitive.
The long form stuff.
I think even reviews are probably too slow for a magazine.
Well, it depends, because some magazines get reviews out.
Yeah, they get the lead time, and they end up being first and stuff. Like, I know, like, one of the Nintendo magazines over here that has got, like, you know, Sonic Colors reviews way before it would hit online.
Game Informer's review of Super Mario Galaxy was sitting on my dining room table before I got the game, and we got the game a full week and a couple of days before it came out. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, they had that game a long time before we did. Because you figure they need at least 2 weeks lead time after they finish writing their review to get it into a magazine.
I feel like if magazines are going to do reviews, they should give them a little more space. I've found that a lot of magazine reviews of games are just so compact that they could almost write it without playing it. I'm not saying they do, but you almost could sometimes. I mean, if it's half a page, that's big. Half a page. If you think about the reviews we do, we have to play the game so much more in depth and explain what's going on. And maybe we overdo it sometimes. But
sure, we do.
I feel like a lot of magazine reviews are almost like capsule reviews. And in that case, when it has so little detail, when it actually has so little commentary, what did you really gain from getting it 3 months before release so you could make the lead time?
Yeah. So you'll see a lot of reviews. They'll have like the quick shot, where it's basically just like, this game is broken. I hate it. Mm-hmm. 2 out of 5. And you're like, well, that was awesome.
It's a weird sort of clash there, because I think one of the benefits of magazines today, you know, with the print medium, is, you know, you end up like reading about things that you might not have seek out yourself. Or obviously related, you know, if it's a gaming magazine, obviously you're germane to the sort of whole topic, but...
Yeah, well, it's a good point, Greg, just to pause real quick, because with a website, it's all link-based, right? So you're not going to click on a story unless you've already decided that you're interested. So basically, it's our job as the writers to like make good headlines and abstracts and things like that to try to attract you to it. Whereas in a magazine, it's a fixed length, so you'll probably read the whole thing, or at least you'll browse through it, and it's more of a graphical format. So you're right, you're more likely to gravitate towards things that you might not otherwise.
It's kind of like foot traffic through a mall or something. You know, you might go to stores you wouldn't otherwise go to.
It's not as a la carte as a website.
With online, you're going to look at stuff that you're interested in with a sort of laser-like kind of precision at times. But the thing with the reviews is, there you might see reviews of games that you're not interested in. But the thing is, a lot of the time, they're so kind of short and almost glib that you do wonder why they do them. Mm-hmm. So there's a weird tension there between that's one of the functions that I like about print, is that you would read about games you wouldn't otherwise, but on the other hand, a lot of the time the coverage is something or nothing. I don't have access to American magazines, but I know John Davison, when he was running, was it GamePro?
Yeah.
He was running GamePro. He doesn't run it anymore, does he? He's moved on again.
No, but he sure turned around the image of that magazine, because that GamePro, when I was a kid, GamePro was shitty.
When I was a kid, which was years later, it was still shitty.
I think it was actually worse by the time Davison came in, and he really turned that around.
But my understanding is he had quite a different sort of paradigm for the way, you know, it was like fewer reviews, more kind of features, original content kind of stuff, to take advantage of those things that I'm talking about with the print medium, where, you know, maybe you're going to read certain kinds of things that you wouldn't otherwise read, but very distinctly different from what you would get online, where it is just like, let's get the score up there for a review and that's what everyone's interested in. You know, the assumption being the kind of person that gets a print magazine now is not just interested in that. And I think that's a pretty good model for print to follow, just intuitively. But I mean, in terms of how that works commercially, I don't really have any numbers to back that up.
Has anybody here read Killscreen magazine?
No.
Or heard of it?
Oh, is that like the retro gamer thing?
No, Killscreen is, I don't even know how I came across it, but I think it was, Killscreen's like, they're kind of trying to be the Rolling Stone of video game magazines, sort of.
No, that sounds like a terrible idea.
No, it's actually a really good magazine, but they put them out quarterly.
Is Obama on every cover?
No, I mean, you should honestly check it out, Johnny. I think you'd really appreciate it, because it's actually
I've never
like...
I've seen it.
John made it up in his head.
It takes like freelance submissions from, you know, game writers, wherever, but not just about like video games. There's no reviews or anything like that. It's all feature stuff, like in-depth, long articles kind of thing, and it's expensive, so it's really niche. It's like $20 an issue or something like that.
Whoa.
But it's all like, you know, it's like just really like high quality stuff. Like it's not meant to be a mass market magazine at all.
Mm-hmm.
Boutique.
Yep, totally a boutique magazine.
That's cool. I'm glad things like that exist. I don't know if that appeals to me very much. I mean, the thing is, I don't even read other gaming websites really. And I never have. I've always had a very limited palette for gaming media. And part of it's because, I mean, after a while, I got accustomed to a lot of the press releases just go straight to my email. I talk to, you know, you guys. I talk to other people on the staff. So, yeah, especially once I started listening to these podcasts, I'm at the point where, you know, I almost don't even need to read websites. I don't have to go to forums. I certainly don't need to read magazines. I haven't for years anyway. Mm-hmm. So my need for more gaming media is non-existent.
I've struggled with magazines and how I use them, because I get them primarily because I just do. I mean, I have the discount card at GameStop, which some years is a good investment, some years isn't. But you never know until after the year's over whether or not...
That's how they get you.
I know. but some years I do get them. So, like, when they do that buy two, get one free deal, I mean, you can cover the whole magazine with one of those deals.
Are you glad that you get Game Informer, though? I mean, I don't want to read Game Informer.
There are some things in there that are interesting to read, like some of their long-form research-based features. But by and large, I mean, I flip through the pages, look at the pictures of the games, look at the score, read their little bullet points, and I'm like, next. If it's a game I'm actually interested in, I might actually sit there and read it. Or if a game gets, like, a hideously low score or an unexpectedly high score, I might go through and read it. Like, if a game gets a 2, I'm going to stop and read it, because odds are there's something about this that makes it hilarious.
You know, I think one thing that magazines are better at is game previews.
Yes.
Because the layouts are a big part of that, because you get the logo or the title, you get nice high-quality screenshots, and maybe it's just that they're willing to do it, because, and I'm not just indicting our website, I think most websites don't do a good job of preview coverage.
Previews are hard work. I mean...
They are. They're very research intensive, for sure.
And a lot of times it's hard to get the information you need, because you can't just go to a publisher and be like, hey, tell us everything about this game. They'll be like, no.
Because they want to control a flow of information. They want to kind of drip it out, you know, building this sort of hype up to release date. And the other thing is, previews, you know, are not going to be strong, opinionated pieces. You know, they're usually going to be mostly fact-based. Maybe there's some hands-on stuff, but a lot of the time, even if there is hands-on stuff, it's
in magazines, there usually isn't hands-on stuff. That's rare.
But that's the thing. I mean, even if there is hands-on stuff, on websites even, you know, if it's impressions, it's kind of, it's guarded, and it's like, well, you know, there's this much time until it comes out, and, you know, they try not to be, you know, overly opinionated, because you could burn bridges that way. We saw
EGM got into some shitstorm with that not too long ago.
That was with Ubisoft, right? Or...
Yeah, that was before EGM shut down and then was resurrected.
So you get that issue, but that's the point. I think with preview coverage, therefore, a lot of the interest of seeing it is visual, like, you know, concept art, the screenshots. You know, it isn't so much about just what could be conveyed with text. So, yeah, I mean, obviously, you might want to watch videos or whatever online, which is nice. Obviously, that's a big advantage that it's got over print. But like you said, if you've got your people that know what they're doing with the layout and all that kind of stuff, and then you know it's, you've got the appropriate amount of text to kind of give the context to all this imagery, that can be a real nice way to just kind of familiarize yourself. Like, this is what this game is. And now, yeah, I know that, and I'll keep that in mind for, you know, when it comes out or whatever.
So how I was introduced to Beyond Good and Evil, at one point it was a GameCube title. Now, it was never a GameCube exclusive, but they had only announced it as a GameCube title, if that makes sense, called Project BG&E.
Yeah.
And Game Informer had a 3-inch tall column about the game in their like quick hits preview section, and this picture of this really amazing looking like Hydra monster. And it said, the preview said nothing. I mean, it was basically like, this is a game, we don't know a whole lot about it. But that one image of the game with just some text, that was enough to kind of lock me in on that game until more info came out. Or else, oh, this is kind of a Zelda clone. But okay, fine, whatever. And I followed that game in part because of how that preview format was. You'd never see a preview like that on a website, because there's no point in them running down all this information they had to go through to write a paragraph.
Yeah, it doesn't really fit into any of the pre-existing templates. I think as I've sort of flipped through the new EGMs that I get now, one thing that really interests me is how a lot of times they'll have a 2-page feature with a layout that looks completely different than anything else in the magazine. I think it shows that graphic design and the art of publishing is not really valued online. I mean, I think our website looks really nice, but every page looks the same. It's designed that way on purpose, right, you know, for convenience. But in every magazine has a person whose sole job it is to arrange things in a way that looks interesting. And there is no equivalent online. And that's nice. Content-wise, it doesn't really change anything, but as you guys have both said, it can draw your eye to something that you might not otherwise read. And I think that's a big thing, you know, in terms of like video content. Obviously, it's a huge advantage of websites as they can show these videos. I recently subscribed to Giant Bomb, and I really enjoy their videos. That's the reason that I paid them, is because their videos are hilarious and really interesting and informative. And even then, I don't watch all of them. I mean, they'll put up quick looks of games that I don't care about. And even if it might be an entertaining video, but that's 20 minutes to sit down and watch that. Sometimes in a magazine, it's nice to flip through and see a piece of concept art that takes you 2 seconds to look at and understand.
Or know that you can come back and peruse the rest of it when you feel like it.
Peruse.
Yeah. And then you can go find a video, but a video content in particular is very a la carte. Because there's not a continuous stream of game videos that just queues itself up and lets you sort of browse videos. You have to go and click on a particular video. Something has to have already made you want to watch that video, or you're not going to watch it.
Right. The only thing they really have to make you possibly want to watch is if they have some sort of aggregator that highlights videos that are trending. But even then, that means there has to be some reason that people wanted to watch it to begin with.
Yeah.
So in my Beyond Good and Evil example, nobody was going to watch a video about a game called Project BG&E, because that's a stupid title. And it would have caught nobody's attention. But that like one image that there with that really ambiguous paragraph, that was enough.
And the one thing I'll say for Edge, when I've got issues with that, is like their differentiation between different parts of the magazine is very strong. Like, reviews is very utilitarian. It's just a few screenshots and it's pretty much a stream of text and a score.
And a 5.
Yeah, and a 3 for your favorite series.
But the other stuff in there, the different features, interviews, retrospectives, whatever it may be, can look completely different from one another and from that part of the magazine. Because I know, like, having read plenty of magazines over the years, that some would kind of cookie cutter, you know, just very, you know, every part of the magazine was standardized. Mm. Presumably just because, as you said, you know, it is a certain expense of creative energy to make the layouts unique.
Oh yeah, and every website is like that.
And yeah, websites are for very technical kind of, you know, obvious reasons, really.
Partly, yeah. But I think there's a certain, I think there's a certain laziness too. It's like, well, we don't want to have to mess with that every time. I mean, I'm giving some advice out here to the listenership. I can't say you'll make any money off of it, but if you want to make a famous and distinctive and interesting website, treat the design layout like you would a magazine. I don't know of anyone who does that.
There are some websites that do, like, they have custom banners for every game, or every important game.
That's a start, but I think this would go way beyond that.
Yeah, I know, but I mean, it's something.
Sometimes the font changes from page to page in EGM.
Yeah.
The color scheme, completely. I mean, you couldn't look at the page and know it was EGM, but if you already know the magazine you're reading is EGM, it's kind of amazing to flip through it.
There's so much
work put into that. It's mm-hmm. just...
It looks really
it's
good.
Just the look of it. There's no website that does that. None. Not gaming, not anything. So if you want to make something really special, maybe that's a way to do it. I don't know. Anyway, we better move on. John?
Next. Okay. All right. Plug of Bugs in London writes, "Dear RFN, I have a question for you guys to cogitate upon. It's actually two questions. In this era of digital distribution and e-content and the interwebs as a whole, why is it that Nintendo games in particular are still so fragmented when it comes to release schedules? Australia and European games are often several months later than their American counterparts, and in the case of some games, hint, hint, Greg, don't see a release at all. I understand phased releases for hardware, but for software, it's been a moot point since probably early last gen. Greg is still regularly importing. Your thoughts, gentlemen?"
Yeah, so... Europe is pretty straightforward. There's like 7 languages that they're translated into.
Yeah, that's the minimum.
It's usually 5 in one is what's on the discs.
English, German, French, Spanish, and Italian.
Mm.
So, I mean, that's not an insubstantial amount of effort.
Mm-hmm.
In the case of Australia, it's because nobody cares. I mean, I hate to... Well, first off, they get PAL versions of games. They're not going to get it before Europe gets it.
They're a PAL region because their television standard runs on PAL. It's not so much an issue these days because most TVs that are manufactured can display both. But going back to the early days of the gaming industry, you know, Australian TVs wouldn't have been able to play non-PAL versions.
Right. But traditionally, they do get European versions of games. So, and I think by and large, they still do, don't they?
Yeah.
So they're not going to get the game before Europe gets it, because that would
make the problem is that it's a kind of weird little subsidiary of the European market, but geographically it's very much displaced from it.
Yeah, it's out there on its own.
I have two reasons why this still happens today. Number one, I won't go into, but it's something we've talked about before. Video game companies in general have poor coordination among their global branches. Nintendo, in particular, I think, has quite poor coordination.
They have edicts that may or may not be followed.
It goes into some really mundane stuff like corporate structuring and shit you don't want to hear us talk about, but it sucks, and it should probably improve. That's part of why this happens. But number two, and I think you can draw a comparison here to the movie industry, where movies are usually released the same day around the world. Despite all the languages, then, you know, they're subtitled and whatever.
That's changed a hell of a lot, though, because of online piracy. I mean, I remember, you know, if you just look at it this simply, Star Wars Episode 1 didn't come out for like 6 weeks after its American date. Star Wars Episode 2 came out on the same day. That 3 years of just ridiculous people torrenting shit made a big difference to say.
Well, the thing is, they probably could have done it before then and they just didn't.
Back then, I think the issue was they probably felt, look, if we want to take the actors out and do all this press junket shit and do all this, you know, it'd be nice to space it out and we can pound each market harder if we space out the release schedule. But then when piracy comes in, and it's seemingly so sort of pervasive, they felt that it's not really that big of a deal to have, you know, people on talk shows in different countries. You know, let's just get it out there.
Yeah, and that part doesn't even factor in with games, because you don't have red carpet events for games anyway.
Well, you might for like Halo.
Bullshit. But the real point is, the main reason that movies are different is something that our friend Dennis Dyack actually used to talk about quite a bit. It's that games are worked on right up until they go to print, which is only a matter of 2 or 3 weeks before the release date. Movies are finished far in advance, and there's a built-in set of time for them to do marketing and, you know, send trailers out and stuff like that. It's a cultural difference. There's no reason that games can't be done that way. They just aren't.
I mean, there's some films probably. Like, I think, wasn't it like, didn't Two Towers go really close to the end? Like, they almost didn't get that out in time.
That's a rare.
But that is really rare. Culturally, well, there's a big
difference.
The
thing
big
is
difference.
With games, I mean, you have to get them out because after a while, they will literally start looking old compared to other things coming out on the market.
It's not as much of an issue for movies, I guess.
There's also the issue with the movie of even if they're still editing the movie, you have a script. Mm-hmm. You know what was said. You can get it translated out. With games, it's not quite so. I mean, it's not like they're shooting. The stuff can be changed on the fly even up until the last few minutes.
Yeah, but I mean, to be fair, let's not overstate the localization element in it. Because, you know, a lot of the time, there's, you know, ExciteBots. What's that got to do with localization?
Look, it's hard to translate how to shake the Wii remote.
Is Kirby not coming out at the end of this year in Europe because of the localization? I rather doubt it.
Yeah.
That's got to be more the individual priorities of the different branches of Nintendo.
Yeah, that has more to do with the first reason I stay, which is just poor coordination.
Yeah, and it could be just the fact that they don't want to staff enough people to allow a coordinated launch.
Oh, no, their European operations are big enough to handle it. They just don't want to cannibalize Donkey Kong.
Or maybe they just don't want to coordinate stuff at the same time. They don't want to.
I mean, first of all, in terms of the issue of Nintendo being kind of worse about this than other platform holders, I mean, the thing is that because they are such a Japanese company, especially obviously compared to Microsoft, who literally aren't, they're a Western company, you know, I mean, you're not really kind of seeing it from the other side, like all the times that, say, Japan gets their releases screwed over or garbled or they,
or they
don't
just
get
don't
stuff.
Get them.
Because we don't hear about that because we don't care.
And neither does Japan because it's Microsoft.
Well, maybe Japan doesn't care either, you know, because they're too addicted to Monster Hunter and Pokemon to notice anything else. But, you know, I mean, the point is that with Nintendo being Japan-centric, we get the short end of the stick, generally speaking, whereas, you know, maybe with the other platform holders, they just get it elsewhere. Nobody kind of really pays much attention. But to me, this is a kind of flip side to what happened, you know, the early days with Nintendo. It was very much like they did everything, you know, with Europe by remote, but it was very much sort of a casual, almost dismissive sort of attitude to the market, you know, just how long stuff took to come out. I think the Super Nintendo came out like a full year after it did in America.
Yeah, that's insane.
I mean, it's just ridiculous. So, I mean, I had a Super Famicom for like the better part of 2 years. While everyone else was still, you know, dealing with the NES or whatever.
Do you remember Animal Crossing in Australia? I think it came out more than 2 years after the European release.
That game had significant localization that it didn't get otherwise. They flipped the seasons.
I'm actually not sure that they ever did. I think when they finally did release it, it just had this. It was exactly the same as the European.
As we said, I mean, Australia is a whole other set of, you know, can of worms, really. But I mean, I think the difference is that before, in the really early days, we had these sort of really nasty things that would happen. It was simply because they didn't recognize, you know, the kind of full value of the market, and they weren't willing to set up anything that had any kind of autonomy that would know the market conditions, you know, on an indigenous basis. Today, some of these differences that we have are because they have these branches where they are thinking more on their own lines. They are acting more autonomously. Like, you know, ExciteBots, I think, is an example of that, where Europe just, you know, could probably to some extent go along with Japan, just made a decision like, yeah, well, the Americans are getting out. Well, we don't want it. We're looking at our marketing, you know, bandwidth, if you like. And
see, I think they did a wait and see, and they saw the sales in America, which is a trickle-down effect because Nintendo of America pooch-screwed that game in the first place.
But Kirby as well, clearly, I think that is just the decision that was made. And, you know, this time this was not taking a lead from Japan or anything. That's like, you know, as James alluded to, you know, they thought, let's put DK front and center as the side-scrolling platformer for the holiday season.
The DK franchise is important, but I seem to recall it having more of a European importance than it does in other places.
It was bigger in Europe than in Japan.
Yeah,
not surprising, like, it's made in Europe. It has sort of a European style to it.
I think it does have the importance I would attach to it. If it's not exceptional, the only thing I would say is that, like in America, it helped spur more Super NES sales. mm-hmm. when it came out back in 94 or whatever it was. But the thing is that in Europe, Super NES was starting from a lower position.
Right. So there may be more of an emotional attachment to that series.
I don't know. But I think it's clear that they felt that. You know, I think Kirby's got a bit of a checkered history with Europe.
Yeah, so they probably felt like this game is more important to us than Kirby is, so we want to make sure it gets its own spotlight.
That doesn't explain why they couldn't have released Kirby before Donkey Kong, just like they are in America.
Because they don't want to cannibalize the other one either.
Yeah, maybe they just feel the margins are too fine, especially if Kirby's is perceived to be relatively more obscure here. And that's the point I'm making. I think today, these sorts of disparities are more created by the fact that you have got these regional subsidiaries that are making decisions on the ground, as it were. Whereas in the past, it was just more because of, you know, this centralization, and they had this sort of dismissive attitude to some of the less prominent regions. And so in terms of, you know, why is it still happening? Well, it's happening for different reasons now, I think, in the main.
When Nintendo inevitably puts a European in charge in Europe, I think that's when you'll really see them do more of their own decision making than they do now.
I mean, you could make an argument that, you know, Nintendo, to what extent they have given autonomy, you know, to the different regions, is still, you know, pretty damn centralized, and you will probably see that change, perhaps a bit slowly with Nintendo. There's a bit of inertia there, but I think it will change.
Well, sir, I mean, if you look at like the American branch, I certainly think under Reggie's watch, Nintendo of America is far more competent than before.
Absolutely.
Right, but I think their freedom hasn't changed very much.
Yeah, it still seems like sometimes their hands are tied.
Yeah, we get better explanations for why they do what they do, but what they do hasn't changed that much, because I don't think there's a whole lot they can do about it.
I do think, though, that they probably use the expertise that they now have in their North American management team, North American-based North American management, and it does provide more of a feedback loop to NCL versus where before, where it was probably more like NCL was just like, yep, that's great, whatever. We're just going to do what we want to do.
There were times back in my early days, so this was, you know, 7-8 years ago probably, where I would interview people in Nintendo, like PR managers and, you know, people like that. And I would ask them about Japanese games, you know, and try to get like a status on them or something. They'd never heard of it before. Why do I know about this game and you don't? You work for Nintendo. Your job is to help decide which Japanese games will be brought to America. You've never even heard of it? Now, I think the people at Nintendo of America will know exactly what you're talking about, and they'll give you a long, detailed answer of why they're not bringing it to America. But they're still not bringing it to America. Right. I mean, the result hasn't changed that much. I think NOA is better run now. The things that they do are executed better, but they're not really making the big decisions any more than they were before.
And there's still, you know, underlying differences in the markets that are not going to go away. You know, I mean, it's just, you know, they have different demographic factors, economic, the heritage issue, as we said, what has been popular in those markets in the past, you know, affects how you can play on nostalgia and all this kind of stuff. So it just doesn't make commercial sense to have everything be perfectly harmonized. Right. So I wouldn't expect to see that. Now, yeah, certain times you could point certain things at why it's happening. There isn't an obvious intuitive explanation, all that, and yeah, that could be bungling. I'm never going to write off incompetence as some borderline possibility.
That's the Capcom explanation, though, because Capcom is terrible about
Sega.
Releasing in different time frames.
So you talk about branch problems with Sega of America. It's pretty much non-existent anymore. They shut down that branch because they were fucking idiots. couldn't handle it.
Think, how screwed up is that? I mean, it's the only of America that's run out of Europe. It's insane.
Yeah,
it's probably better run now than it was.
Oh, it's much better run now. It's so well run now. Well, maybe I might be overstating it, but they recognize that they made mistakes in the past, which the old Sega PR teams they adamantly defended Shadow the Hedgehog. They've ran an advertising campaign for Sonic Colors that reads, "If this game sucks, we'll quit." they have
Holy
given interviews
shit.
Basically saying that we made a lot of bad games and they're so bad they poisoned the brand, so we're delisting them from our websites.
That's true. They're clearing off store shelves.
They didn't
stuff,
happen.
Right? Yeah.
Officially, those games don't exist.
John, can you bring it home for us?
Sure. Ryan from Anaheim, California writes, I'm going to be traveling to Japan next month and will be keeping an eye open for DS games. Aside from Moenden, can you suggest any import-friendly titles?
Import-friendly is the tricky bit.
It's funny, two questions, two letters today about importing from different perspectives. You know, there are two Uwendon games,
yes.
So you could get both of those to start.
You got the fighting games like Jump Ultimate Stars and Jump Superstars that are like Smash Brothers.
They're supposed to be all good. I was thinking of, actually it's a GBA game, but the original Rhythm Heaven never came out.
Yeah, I would certainly recommend looking
into
that.
The Taiko Drum Master games are pretty good.
At least really?
Yeah, that's my understanding. They're actually pretty good rhythm games.
For DS?
Yeah. They come with like little drumstick things.
I have no idea how easy it would be to find, because I assume it wasn't like a huge hit or anything, but the Sandlot Mech game for DS that Nintendo published that I talked about a few weeks ago, Chosoju Mech MG, that's playable. It's got Japanese text in it, plenty of it in terms of dialogue, but in terms of playability, it's not really a problem. So it's not super import friendly.
Daigaso too.
Yeah, well, yeah, if you haven't got Carly to ship it.
That's right, if you haven't been part of the great migration of Jam with the band.
Yeah, so the Japanese name for that is Daigaso Band Brothers DX, and you can find that. There's even an expansion pack, which is actually a GBA cartridge that you plug in.
Although I understand that's hard to find.
But yeah, I'm not surprised.
I mean, if you look at Wii games, obviously you'd have to find a way, a means of playing them, unlike with DS games. Mm-hmm. But there's quite a few, isn't there? You've got your Captain Rainbow, which is completely import unfriendly, but Disaster would be import friendly.
It's just not gameplay friendly.
Yeah.
I was thinking Okamiden, actually, which is definitely going to have a lot of story stuff that you won't be able to understand, but gameplay-wise, I doubt that...
That's coming out, though.
It's coming out in January, you know, if you don't want to wait.
Well, he's going next month, though. I mean, it's only going to be 2 months.
Next month being November.
Yeah, like I said, it's only going to be 2 months.
Look, I know people who import games when they come out a week early.
Yeah,
so
but they're...
They're the crazies.
Face training might be just shits and giggles. I mean, just to show people and get their reactions.
Guys,
when they get home.
Look at this. I mean, if you're going to do that, you could go with Densha Dego, too.
You know, a really interesting one to pick up might be the Friend Collection game.
Tomodachi
Collection, yeah. That's the game, it's almost like The Sims on your DS, but you're using Miis of your friends.
Yeah, I can't imagine. I did download the demo for that. If off the Japanese Nintendo channel, it seemed a bit impenetrable.
I wouldn't pick that up. It's a really strange thing, but if you're into like super weird Japanese stuff, that might be worth picking up, because that's never going to come out over here.
No.
Seemingly not. I think the time's come and gone if it was going to happen.
Yeah, and there are technical reasons as well.
There is the second Tingle game, but that is more of an adventure game than the first one was. So again, I'm kind of struggling to see if that's import friendly enough to... I mean, it's not even out in Europe. I mean, it must be mental.
Oh, it's... I understand that it's completely effed.
That might be a fun one to look for.
Yeah,
then.
but it's in Japanese and it's an adventure game.
And it's Tingle.
They tell you do this and you're like, I don't know what that says. I can't read Japanese.
Another one to think about how import friendly this is kind of debatable. But there's the new Chibi Robo, the Rich Sweep one, which is more like the GameCube Chibi Robo than Park Patrol because it takes place indoors. But
right.
Again, there's a lot of text in that. I played the Japanese Chibi Robo for New Play Control, but that's easy to find information about because lots of people imported that on GameCube. So you had comprehensive guides to help you if you're an importer. Whereas as I've looked into imported that game, no one said anything about it ever. It's like, you know, no one ever bothered to check it out, seemingly. It's really kind of obscure. So that would be a bit of a risk. It's like with the Chibi Robo gameplay, maybe you could just kind of fumble your way through it. But a lot of it is going to be like fixing characters' problems and stuff, I assume. So,
There's the puzzle series, like puzzle series volume X, where X is just a number.
Oh, like there's one that's like, is it Slitherlink or something?
Yes.
It's going to be really good.
That's 5, I think.
Yeah, that's meant to be great. I have no idea available that. I have not seen that on sale for a long time on any of the import stores.
Oh, Jet Impulse. That's the one I was trying to think of. That's supposed to be at least decent.
Is that a puzzle collection also?
Jet Impulse? No, it's a jet fighter game.
Oh.
It's developed by Nintendo.
Actually, you know, you could look for stuff like, I don't know if the Mother 1 and 2 collection is readily available, but there's certainly plenty of translation and walkthrough guides for Mother 1.
Yeah, for
sure.
That's
Earthbound Zero, and that's never come out in English at all, so that would be something you could pick up. Again, it's a GBA game, so...
If you're really hot on bizarro Japanese games, there's the iShield 21 game for the DS that's supposed...
American football RPG?
It's supposed to just be completely fucked and yet still playable in an import mode. Like, even if you don't understand what they're saying, it's going to be like, what?
There's a Wii version of that, too, you know.
Yeah, there is. It's like one guy is like shaped like a refrigerator. It's like, what? What?
They took William Perry's nickname a bit too literally.
It should be a guy shaped like Pac-Man.
It's supposed to be relatively fun game to play. There's the Starfy games. There are more Starfy games in Japan than there are in the US.
There's like another DS game and several GBA games.
Yeah. So if you really dig Starfy, there you go.
All right. Well, hopefully we gave you a few ideas there, Ryan. Have a good trip. I'm jealous. Send us pictures or whatever. Tell us what you ended up picking up.
And then send it to us.
I think Uwindon is definitely your best bet. Those are very, very import friendly. And both of those games have completely separate soundtracks from Elite Beat Agents, but they play exactly the same.
Right.
So you can't go wrong there. They're almost like track packs with crazier graphics.
And just text that you can't read.
Yeah.
Well, to be honest, I couldn't read the text in there either, and it was in a language I understand.
It kind of adds to the charm a little bit.
With the comic book panels, you can figure out what's going on anyway. So I'd say pick up both
of those.
If
you even really want to know.
I would say...
Most of the time.
One thing I would say to do, though, is just go into one of the sort of used game houses and just look around for something that's older that might be worth getting.
Oh, man. If you haven't seen TYP and James Charlton's videos about game shopping in Akihabara, definitely... Watch those before you go.
Roll up in Super Potato and
shit like that. It's awesome.
Yeah, if you can roll up in a Super Potato, just bring a lot of cash. Because there's just so much stuff that you didn't even know existed.
Bring a camera so you can get a photo of yourself sitting in the throne made up of Famicom cartridges.
Yes.
That place is sick. All right, that's going to wrap up the show. Thank you, everybody who wrote in. We had some great emails there. Again, the address is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. We love getting emails.
And if you didn't write in, we don't thank you.
We thank you for listening.
We shank you.
Glad you're back, John.
Some housekeeping here before we go. The Retroactive DS poll is still active for a few days after this episode goes up. You have until Thursday, actually, the first Thursday of November, to get your vote in. And the results are pretty interesting so far. I think a lot of people have complimented the selection of games. So I hope you'll find something that sounds interesting and... some of those games are a little bit obscure, so I put some links up to reviews of all of them, and if you haven't heard of the game, check that out and, you know, do a little research before you vote it. You might, you know, sort of find yourself really interested in a game that you might not have thought of before. So looking forward to that wrapping up and figuring out what we're going to play next. There's a great new episode of Radio Trivia Podcast Edition. It's, of course, Michael Cole, TYP, along with co-host Jimmy C., James Charlton. That's a lot of fun. They play
Jimmy
some
C.
pretty wacky stuff.
Is he a WarioWare character now?
Maybe a gangster.
And TYP is about to fall asleep that entire episode, so it's kind of cute, too. Go check us out on iTunes. Even if you're already subscribed, you can rate the show and write a review for us, and we would really appreciate that. It helps us find new listeners who, of course, help make the show better by writing in listener mail and all kinds of voting on Retroactive and lots of other stuff. You can like the show and get midweek status updates and shit like that over on facebook.com/radiofreenintendo.
John Lindemann is eating a sandwich.
Yes, we're posting up a character art of each one of us provided by David O, and that is a lot of fun too. So all kinds of stuff going over there. And at this point, I also want to make a special announcement. This is early. But we have plans to do a special event coming up in December. It is actually an idea that Carl Castaneda put to us, and we thought it was really exciting. So for right now, we are planning to go ahead with it. It's a live streamed version of Radio Free Nintendo. Some people have predicted it. And right now, I'm calling it RFN Live, doing it for the kids. It's a charity event.
It's for the children. Come on.
In which the idea is that it's basically a RFN marathon / telethon type format. So we think the idea here is that we're going to block out half a day on it. It's a Saturday. Greg won't have to edit that week. We won't do a normal show that week. It'll just be the live one. And you'll have us, some special guests, some other NWR staff people, and basically we're going to block out a big-ass chunk of time. We're talking several hours. I don't want to commit right now because we haven't planned out all the content, but it's going to be, we're preparing for the worst here. It could be a long haul. And basically we'll start off with like an hour-long show. And if enough people donate for Child's Play, we'll extend it out another hour. And the amount that you have to donate to extend it another hour will go up. So it's kind of like Desert Bus for Hope. It's like self-limiting. At some point, it becomes so expensive that you can't keep the show going any longer. But at that point, maybe we've been doing it for 8 hours. So it should be pretty fucking epic. Hopefully, of course, the idea is to raise a lot of money for charity. We thought, you know, if we were going to do like a live audio stream of Radio Free Nintendo, what would really make it special? And I think the sheer endurance of making it a marathon and using that to help raise the money for charity could be a lot of fun. And, you know, I know a lot of people like that our show is pretty long, and this is a way to make it even longer for one special day in a way that won't completely kill off Greg.
Partially kill him.
I'm pretty excited about the prospects. I hope this sounds like something you're interested in. And the reason I'm bringing it up now, it's not happening till Saturday, December 4th. That's the tentative date. But the reason I bring it up now is because we need your ideas to help us fill hours and hours and hours of Radio Free Nintendo Live. So if you have anything, any kind of segment, maybe a special guest within reason, you know, let's be realistic here, but within reason is a special guest that maybe we could bring on the show and talk and fill time. We want to fill time, but we want to fill time with interesting stuff that'll make all of you want to keep listening and keep donating money so you get to hear more and more and more and more of it. So we don't want this to be bland and just, yeah, you know, we want it to be really cool stuff all the way through. And that involves a lot of content planning. And so we want your ideas. What would you like to hear? You know, is there anything that we could do that would be special to the live format? Some kind of interactive thing? We'll definitely have like a chat room set up. We're talking about potentially doing like Skype call-in guests. So, you know, there might be an opportunity for some of the listeners to call in and chat with us in real time and essentially be on the podcast. So maybe some trivia type competitions. We might try to pull together some prizes that we can give out on this. And of course, in order to make this a success, because it's a charity event, we need a lot of people participating. So you don't have to do anything right now, but maybe start thinking about ways in which you could help us promote this to people who might be interested in such a strange event. Of course, we'll try to get some kind of promotion from Penny Arcade since it's their charity. But, you know, anything else we can do to bring people in and get them to maybe donate some money and discover the show and just help out with this would be really cool. So anyway, it's all kind of in its infancy right now, but we're kind of putting it out there. We want to do this. We want to make it happen. And I think, you know, everybody listening can help that out. Send us an email, hit us up on Facebook or in the TalkBack forums, whatever. But let us know what you think and what you would like to sort of get out of this. And we'll definitely consider all the suggestions and really appreciate your feedback. So that is the end of episode 217. Thanks for listening, and we will see you next week.
No.
No.
We're still.
No. Just keep going.
John, you.
If you stopped.
John
fine.
Just fucked it.
If you stop, that's just gonna have to be it for you.
You're done, John. John, you should have come in like the LeBron commercial because you clearly fucked things up even worse.
Well, now that you've stopped, yes, save.
Stop it, yeah, save that.
Definitely.
Just get rid of it. We won't have any questions. We'll just have answers.